Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Uprising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello, folks, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, where we invite all sides to face the music and dance together through conversations for co-creation. Well, I've said it before, and it seems more and more true each day, particularly now as we're dealing with this shutdown and slowdown and so on, that in spite of the polarization and divisiveness in this country, we actually have a deeply united body politic, because the vast majority of us across the political spectrum are coming to realize that our pay-to-play system, where the main focus of legislators is to raise money for re-election and then, of course, get hired as corporate lobbyists when they retire, it just isn't working. And more Americans are coming to the sad conclusion that the will of the ordinary citizen in America doesn't really have that much impact on what legislation actually gets passed. In fact, a study conducted by Princeton University in 2014 concluded, and I quote, "The preferences of the average American appear to have only a minuscule, near zero, statistically non-significant impact on public policy," unquote. You know, young people in particular have realized that the two major parties are so caught up in the system themselves that they can't lift us out of it. According to an NBC News poll in November, 71% of millennials don't like either of the two major parties and would prefer a new third party. Well, maybe it's time that we look outside the box, outside the ballot box, to find a strategy and a solution. Our guest today, Richard Lang, is offering a meta-strategy to give American citizens an independent voice and vote through a new institution for democracy, the National Town Square. His new book that just came out is called Virtual Country, Strategy for 21st Century Democracy, and it just may offer the outside impetus for change we've been waiting for. Welcome, Richard.
Well, thank you, Steve. Glad to be here.
Good. Well, let's get started. Tell us about this National Town Square and how and why it will make a difference.
Well, first of all, let me say that it's the National Town Square, as envisioned and proposed in my book, Virtual Country, is part of a longer-term strategy to establish some national infrastructure for civic engagement. The key to really understanding in how it relates to the title Virtual Country is that, as you pointed out in your introduction to the show, that the system that we're all used to participating in terms of our political system anyway, is one where people definitely feel they're not having an influence on our elected representatives. And the system itself just appears to be corrupted in so many places where the corrupting influence of big money has interjected itself. And so, you know, I think we start from the premise that fixing that system is certainly worthwhile as an effort, but that's not what the National Town Square is about. The National Town Square is about setting up a long-term and a new national institution that is citizen-run that would provide a mechanism for citizens collectively and individually to provide advisory input to our elected representatives. But here's the key. That would not happen as a new a new law or as a result of a constitutional convention or in any way related to making the currently broken system suddenly work better. Really, what it's designed to do is to provide an alternative, something that operates in parallel with our existing system. And the key to it is establishing a new venue, a gathering place, as it were, where citizens of all stripes can show up, initially open an authenticated voting account, something that's just as secure as, your banking accounts or tax accounts, where you're known to be the citizen that you say you are. And other than your location, nothing else is known about you other than you are a bona fide, in this case, American citizen that lives in a particular area. And the reason that's important is because ultimately what this mechanism is designed to do is because it is a new venue for citizens to gather in, its power lies in participation. So it's designed to make it easy for citizens to participate. It's designed to be issue-centric, meaning that no political party information is ever collected. All we know is that these are real citizens. And because of that, as citizens consider various issues one at a time, usually over a little bit of a spread of time, a window in which to learn about things, that what matters, what becomes the most important metric is how many people are showing up to voice their individual voices and therefore the collective voice. And as that becomes a large number, then suddenly we have a new counterbalance to the corrupting influence of big money in politics. That was a mouthful, sorry, but it was a big question.
Well, that's really a good beginning. So essentially you're talking about a totally independent new piece of national infrastructure that wouldn't have voting power like Congress does, but as people show up in larger and larger and larger numbers, voicing their opinions about various issues, then that would be something that those who are running for office would have to take notice of. That's pretty much what you're saying, right?
Well, yeah, and I guess what I'm saying also is that the only thing that seems to matter to the politicians running for office is whether they're going to have the turnout that they want in the next election. And, we're geared as citizens to think that civic engagement means every couple of years we show up for an election and we vote for a person or people that are supposed to represent us. But in between the elections is when we don't have a voice collectively. There's really nowhere to go, and so there's no real pressure point for citizens to do anything. But on the other hand, if you had a venue that made it easy for citizens to assemble, and I also want to clarify that we're not talking about like a daily survey on different things. This would be a venue where periodically, big issues are put forth in front of citizens. And by the way, those issues are suggested by citizens themselves. So it's not like some, third party is deciding for all of us what we should be voting on. This is, the topics, the issues rise up from citizens themselves. They're considered in a safe space where there are no trolls or no bots. They're just citizens. And within that safe space, there is educational information that has been vetted to be factually accurate. There are ways that citizens can learn about a topic, discuss it in safe, moderated discussions, again, inside of the National Town Square. And as a result, we end up with a number that relates to how many people are participating. A number that, as it grows, exerts more pressure, more influence, let us say, on our elected representatives. And, let's just give you an example. Let's say that there was an announcement made by our government that it planned on taking some major action that a lot of citizens thought, wow, that's kind of scary. I don't know if I want our government taking that particular action. Use your imagination. It could be any number of things.
We don't really need an imagination in this era, actually. There's so many of those that are happening right now.
Exactly. So just, you know, pick your issue. It's a big one. It's the kind of issue that keeps people up at night. And right now, you know, people may have an opinion about that issue, but there's no, I mean, it's great. We can march, you know, once a year or once a month in the streets. People go to town council meetings. But as far as the politicians are concerned, there's no place really that they can be afraid of in terms of, you know, numbers, because even, you know, town council meetings or marches on the mall, yes, they do portend, you know, what may be a trend, but they don't quantify it, right? As opposed to having a place where you can look and say, oh, wow, this particular issue, it's been put up for citizen input for the last week, and, you know, we've got 100 million people that have weighed in on it. And you know, X number feel a certain way, Y number feel another way, but combined, the number of people equals far more, let's say, than voted in the last election, or that are likely to vote in the upcoming election. So politicians look at that number and they go, wow, you know, I've got as many people as I know are going to vote, and 80% of them are telling me this is the way that they feel about this particular issue. That's real influence, because the writing's on the wall. You know, any such politician is going to know, well, if I go against this vote, I better be able to make a compelling explanation about it, because I'm going to face these voters. I already know what percentage of them disagree with me on this very important topic. So, you know, that's something that can happen any day of the year. It's not restricted to once every 2 years. And that, you know, breaking free of that 2 year in civic engagement paradigm is part of what the National Square is about.
You know, there's another piece related to that that you've outlined in the book, and it's such an unusual perspective. And the more I think about it, the more true it is. And that is that there is a way for this National Town Square as an advisory institution to have an impact, even as candidates are getting donations from major corporations and other special interests. And you use a certain metric that talks about how, because of so few people who actually vote, how the impact of money becomes less and less important as more and more people participate. Could you say more about that? I think that's really important.
Yes, that's a really good point. Let me start by laying just a foundational premise for our listeners, right?
Good.
And that is that in what is envisioned as a National Town Square, the ability to access a secure, verifiable, essentially voting booth in your pocket or purse makes it super easy for people to have access. It's not like during a regular election every couple of years where, you know, there, you know, people have to get to the polls. They might have to take time off of work. You know, there's a lot of planning that goes into getting a vote cast. There are strategies put forth by certain groups to discourage people from voting, especially people who might be voting against their interests. So, you know, again, just as a foundation, we're used to this one every 2 years paradigm. With a National Town Square, anybody would be able to reach into their purse or pocket and or get on their laptop and suddenly access a particular issue for voting. Okay, so let me tell you why I said that first, because the statistic that you're referencing that's in my book has to do with the average turnout during national elections, which runs between 30% and 60%. The larger numbers tend to be at four-year elections. The smaller numbers tend to be at the midterms. But here's the thing. If we know, for instance, that even in a, you know, big turnout of 55% of the population, where 45% did not turn out to vote, in that 55%, there are different groups vying for a win, right? And so the key to that win is voter turnout, right? In other words, a particular, you know, constituency or, you know, a candidate, a faction, let's say, knows that, wow, if we want to win this particular election, we need to motivate our base. We need to motivate our audience. And why do they need to do that? Because they want their base or their audience to outnumber, in terms of turnout, those that have turned out on the opposite side, let's say, right? But it still all happens within this window of, you know, 30 to 60%. So big money has a big role to play, because basically big money says, hey, wow, if I can provide a disproportionate turnout for a particular group or candidate, then I get to register a win because of my money, because I've spent more money on marketing, on advertising, on a ground game, on, you know, whatever it happens to be. So now let's go back to my foundational premise. Even though this is not the case right now, we certainly don't have anything close to 100% participation in elections here. I mean, there are countries that make voting mandatory, but for the time being, we're stuck between 30 and 60. If there was a way to start to approach, maybe not 100%, but, you know, 90%, let's say, you know, large numbers, what it means is that in terms of absolute numbers, any particular special interest group or political constituency can never have more influence than their actual numbers as a total of, as a percentage of the total. I hope it's clear. It may be a little confusing because I don't have in the book there's a chart that I could be pointing to. But again, let's just say if 100% of the people were voting, then no amount of money spent by someone trying to affect turnout would have any impact, because everybody'd already be voting. So at that point, again, hypothetically, 100% of the people vote. Whatever the actual percentage of that voting population feels a certain way about a particular issue, that's the most votes they're going to get, is how many people they actually have in terms of real numbers out of the total, right? That's so it mitigates – you know, the influence of that group, and it makes it essentially eliminates the value of spending big dollars to get better turnout. Now, if you want to get
good,
spend big dollars,
thanks, Richard. We're taking a break, as you can hear. So we'll be back after the break, and we'll amplify this a little bit more. Thanks.
All right.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Imagine, it is the year 2039. A single corporation controls most of the world through genetic modification, food, and drugs. A senior geneticist's lover dies, launching him on a quest to take down the psychopathic CEO and the handful of elite families that control the corporation. The feature film Corporate Prey, based on the novel of the same name, points us toward a dystopian future where we seem to be headed. Huge corporations do largely control our farms and our pharma, and wealthy elites seem to be operating to the detriment of most humans. Can we reverse course? Can prophecy lead to prevention? Can a movie awaken enough of us in time? To find out more and how you can help bring this enlightening film to light, go to CorporatePrey.com. Corporate Prey. That's P-R-E-Y.
In the wake of a disaster, what one thing can you send that will help people the most? A blanket. A tent, a sandbag, a doctor. Actually, if you send a monetary donation, you send all these things. Even a small donation can make a big impact and can quickly become exactly what people affected by disaster need most.
In the wake of a hurricane, your monetary donation can make a huge difference to those in need. To donate, visit supporthurricanerelief.org. That's supporthurricanerelief.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
This is Steve Behrman. We're back with Wiki Politiki and our guest, Richard Lang. Before the break, we were talking about how this new institution, National Town Square, could impact our political system from the outside. I'm reminded of this famous quote from Jim Hightower. He said, "If God had meant us to vote, he would have provided candidates." And, you know, he said this many years ago, and it certainly seems that one of the reasons why people don't vote is because they really don't see the impact of their vote. However, if there were such a thing as the National Town Square, if people could see the large numbers of their fellow citizens who agree about a certain policy, I think that would actually motivate people to come out to the polls and consequently diminish the influence of big money. Is that what you're saying, Richard?
Yes, I am. I mean, that's certainly part of what I'm saying. And also, what's connected to that, and, you know, we haven't spent a lot of time yet talking about how the National Town Square might be organized, but let me provide at least one aspect that's important, and that is that, as I mentioned before, the National Town Square would not collect any information from its participants, certainly, especially not having to do with their political affiliation. And the reason I bring that up is because this is a space, you know, we're locked in right now into a two-party paradigm. You know, maybe once in a while there's talk of a third party or an independence, but it still has to do with two parties, and we tend to get manipulated as a result of that, because both parties find wedge issues that they can use to motivate their base to turn out. At the National Town Square, what we would have is an issue-based democracy, a no-party system, as it were, you know, within this, you know, virtual advisory mechanism. And the reason that's important is because, you know, we could find that addressing issues one at a time outside of the identification with the political party, just the issue itself, we already know from polls that Americans agree on more than two-thirds of all the major issues. And when you take an issue and you sequester it, you give it its own spotlight, devoid of identification with the political party, then everybody has the freedom to say, okay, well, on this particular issue, here's how I feel. And you know, an example might be, you know, maybe with regards to say the tax cut. You might find someone who is otherwise very progressive, but for some reason in the tax cut, they're very conservative, let's say. And so on this particular issue, they have the freedom to weigh in with a conservative view on the tax cut, but they're not lumped in and said, oh, well, that person's, you know, just a right winger or a Trumpian or whatever. It's just one vote on one issue. The next issue might come up and it might be, you know, a national legalization of marijuana. And that same person might say, well, on that one, I'm really voting more like a progressive. I think that should be legalized, and, you know, and so on. So It separates the issues from the identification with a political party, and that doesn't happen anywhere else right now in our country. So part of the design of a National Town Square is really to enable issues to be considered in their own right by individual citizens, and have those decisions, that consideration, be informed by fact-verified information.
You know, this sounds that's totally radical. And we've also just touched on the idea that this would be a completely independent institution. So how would this work independently as a non-corporate, non-governmental, non-partisan organization? How might it be funded? How might it be vetted so that the impartiality is impeccable?
Well, that's a really important, a really great question. As a matter of fact, that very question is what ultimately continued to motivate me to finish writing the book, which, by the way, I started, you know, many years ago, and it was rewritten several times just in 2017. But, you know, what you're talking about is sort of the nuts and bolts structurally. How do we do this? If it's not governmental and if it's not a corporation, how's it put together? And, you know, like many achievements that we've had in this country, it's one that requires forethought, careful consideration, and a commitment to a long-term strategy. It's one reason I think you refer to it as a meta strategy. What's envisioned here is really a second chance for citizens who are ready for a new paradigm, who are ready to provide a collective advisory vote to essentially create their own mechanism for doing so. And when I say citizens, I'm not excluding elected representatives who can certainly and, you know, hopefully will, we have some evidence of that already, resonate with this mechanism. But ultimately, it would be a group of citizens themselves from all walks of life that form an initial founding steward organization, a nonprofit with a rotating group of individuals, maybe a couple dozen or so initially, that may have and likely will have very different and opposing views on individual issues. But what they will have in common is that they're willing to stand up and pledge that the integrity of this mechanism, of a national town square, of an institution like this is so important that they want to be identified with it, that they want to promote it, that they want the country and the world to know, hey, what is being formed is new infrastructure for civic engagement. It's a new national institution. And as such, it takes time to do. I mean, even if the National Town Square were ready to go live today, right, it would not be a good idea to turn it on. Why? Because who would be owning it, right? Who is it that would be putting their name to it? Citizens might hear it and go, oh, it's another startup or it's some Facebook, you know, idea or, you know, who knows what. But it's not something for me to introduce as a final thing or for, you know, Democrosoft or for anyone, but for this new group that's, by the way, that is being formed as we speak, the initial founding stewards. This is a group of citizens. They might be not just from politics, but from government, from entertainment, from sports, from the arts, from education, various places. And what they would have in common is these individuals would be known for their integrity, for being straight shooters. And, you know, I know that's a tall order, but I believe those people are out there. We've seen evidence already of attempts from actual elected representative to somehow separate themselves from the highly partisan world with very little success. But this gives them a mechanism to do so. It's a way of identifying with not just resistance to what we don't like, but rather with a vision for something that's long overdue, and which, by the way, has only been possible for the last 10 years or so. If I may, Steve, I just want to take a minute to underscore that point, because
sure.
Go
ahead.
one of the main points in the book is that, you know, what I'm pointing to, this particular strategy for setting up a new national institution for collective advisory input from citizens wasn't possible even 10 years ago. What's happened now is for the first time in known human history, we have the ability for an unlimited number of citizens to show up in one place at one time. And that's online. And because we have banking level security and because we, you know, the technology is already here now, and then you add to that the accessibility that comes with being able to connect to one's voting account and to weigh in on a topic simply by reaching into your pocket or purse, that's new territory for democracy. And so it's very important that be understood. And also for another reason, because, you know, right now it's the early days of the realization of the paradigm shift, but it's not going to be long before all kinds of commercial interests recognize that, wow, something like this is needed, and boy, couldn't we make some money doing it? And that would be the antithesis of the purpose of the National Town Square. It's not about making money. It's about creating a new, safe, reliable, neutral space where citizens can have a voice and a vote on a daily basis. So, it's, you know, the group that comes together of citizens to birth this and to manage it and to see it into the future, that takes – it's important to do that right. And it's important because if it's not done right, then citizens will have lost the opportunity. It'll quickly be co-opted by the same commercial interests that have already, you know, had a negative effect on our democracy. So that's why the book now, and that's why your question is important, because, you know, who will own democracy? And that's one of the key – that's one of the chapters in the book, as a matter of fact. And we talk about how to structure – this citizen roundtable, this founding steward organization that will kick off the National Town Square.
And by the way, let me put in a plug for the book. You can find it on Amazon, and if you like it, definitely review it. It's called Virtual Country, and the subtitle, what is the subtitle, Richard? Strategy for a 21st Century Democracy. 21st century democracy. What you said, I mean, there's something so radical in what you proposed and so ironic. Two things. First of all, unlike Facebook or any of these other systems where bots can intervene and act like real people so that the perspective is skewed, as what happened with the input on the net neutrality issue. There were many bots who made their non-human voices heard, and that tipped the scale, so to speak. The other thing is that here we are in a system where every state has its own voting structure, and none of these voting structures are really secure. They're not unhackable. They're not uniform. They're not verifiable. And so here, in a very simple way, somebody using their personal device can access a system where, like their ATM PIN code, they are into a secure system where they know that everybody else participating are other real people, and the system can't be skewed that way. That, ironically, that this is really potentially only verifiable vote that people can actually have right now. I find that very ironic. So let's talk a little bit more about how an institution like this gets funded, how it gets started. You talked a little bit about the roundtable of key people who are coming to the roundtable to discuss, to actually bring this to fruition. Say more about that.
About which aspect, Steve?
Well, about the about how this is going to be funded, perhaps, and how this will be convened as an institution that citizens will recognize belongs to them.
Well, so those are two somewhat different questions. In terms of how citizens will recognize that this belongs to them, I would say, you know, that's that question is investigated at some length in the book. So I would recommend that anybody who's interested in sort of the details go there. In terms of the funding, which is also covered, let me just say that generally, you know, this is a citizen-led initiative, right? So because of that, what's most important is that it not be overtly or even subtly influenced by the interests of big money. Where we're seeing the emergence of this as it unfolds is initially in the nonprofit sector. And one of the possible ways that this may unfold is that an existing nonprofit organization that's nonpartisan in nature may serve as an initial incubation or, you know, convening authority, as it were, a place where, as individuals who will be part of this roundtable, the steward organization, as they come together, they're doing so under the umbrella of an existing, well-respected, well-regarded nonprofit organization. So that's the first thing. This is going to unfold organically. And, by that I mean it's not something that is likely to be pushed on anyone. It's something that is being given an opportunity to take root, which is feels like it already has, and then to grow in a way that represents the people who are helping it grow, right? So whether that's individual citizens who have pre-registered for a voting account at the National Town Square, which, by the way, can be done right now. Anyone can go to nationaltownsquare.us, not com, .us, nationaltownsquare.us, and pre-register for a voting account. So, you know, the people who do so will receive kind of a regular updates on the status of the initiative. And then it's likely going to take philanthropic money to help support this as it grows. But here's the really good news. There have been big undertakings in our country before, things like, you know, putting a man on the moon in the 70s or early 70s, or for instance, you know, Earth Day, where 20 million people came together on one day in the early 70s. And then suddenly we had, you know, the EPA, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, a number of things that came out of it. Those undertakings were large, but they didn't happen necessarily overnight. You know, we didn't put a man on the moon overnight. Another example is the infrastructure for roads and bridges. You know, that infrastructure was envisioned at a time when there were not 230 million automobiles running around. It took people in a nonpartisan effort to come together and say, wow, you know, this is something that our country is going to need, roads and bridges that connect and that make sense. And we did it. And it took place over a period of decades. And I don't think it's going to take anywhere near the amount of time or money to launch the virtual or the National Town Square as it took to put a man on the moon or set up a national infrastructure for roads and bridges. In the relative scheme of things, this is it's an incredibly achievable outcome.
Good. Richard, we'll be back after this break and we'll talk about some other aspects.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
The Shift Network. Presenting transformative programs and events to help you awaken to your full potential so that together we can build the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible. Our classes support you in finding and cultivating your gifts and in bringing those gifts to the world to create tangible change and connect us as global citizens. Go to theshiftnetwork.com or follow the link on the Wiki Politiki sponsors page.
I rescued Toast from a shelter in 2011. I love Toast because she's a lazy diva. Toast does whatever she wants, obviously. She's sleeping right now. She's so loving. She's so comforting. When I walked into the shelter, I knew right then that she was special.
Toast, Instagram star and shelter pet. Amazing adoption stories start in shelters. Start yours today. Visit theshelterpetproject.org to find a pet near you. Brought to you by Maddie's Fund, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Ad Council.
Okay, Steve Behrman back with Wiki Politiki and our guest, Richard Lang. Time flies when you're having fun. This is going very, very quickly. I want to pick up on something that Richard said just before the break, and that is that I want to encourage people to go to the National Town Square site. We'll give it to you once again before the end of the show, and it's, of course, on the Wiki Politiki page. And that brings up a question. When we're dealing with small numbers of participants, at least at the beginning, or even as the thing grows, what are the dangers of one group sort of taking it over, that people kind of loading the gun, so to speak, on one side or another? What's your take on that, Richard?
Well, I mean, it's to be expected that as people find out about it, that they're going to want to affect the outcome by, you know, motivating their constituency to show up first and vote first. But the answer really goes back to what I said earlier in the conversation, which is that this is all about, and this, by the way, is something that anyone who is participating in the National Town Square presumably would already know, but the point is that the value and the relevance of how people are voting is directly related to the overall turnout as a percentage of who can participate. So, for instance, you know, if you have you know, say 200 million people can vote, right? And of that, you get a particular constituency. Let's just take the NRA as example. And the NRA reaches out to its members and says, okay, everybody, you know, the National Town Square is open. There's a vote on gun control. Get out there and, you know, vote pro-gun. Great. The NRA has a membership of about 4 million people, give or take. So even if 100% of them showed up and 4 million people suddenly are weighing in, well, if the grand total of all participants at that moment is only 5 million people, well, then one might look at the result and go, wow, it looks like, you know, 80% of the population wants, no gun control. But then everyone would look at it and go, hold on a second, that's only 5 million out of 200 million. So that's like, you know, a 40th of the population. That's a meaningless vote outcome because the participation level is low. As the participation level goes higher, then it's more important to take note of what the vote is. So let's say at 10 million, then you could say, well, all right, at 10 million people, it looks like maybe, you know, 35-40% have this position on guns. At 100 million people, even if 100% of the NRA voted a particular way, 100 million people show up, well, you know, that 4 million only equals 4% of the total. Now, of course, some of the remaining 96 are also going to be supportive of the NRA view, but the point is it's not going to skew the results, because ultimately the results only matter as the participation is high. And, you know, the other point on this is that, you know, that's a built-in check valve, as it were, so that any elected representatives, if they're referencing the National Town Square, are going to go, well, let's see, you know, this particular issue only had 10 million people participating. Yeah, I'll take note of, you know, of the results, but, you know, it's not going to affect me the same way as I turn around and I go, oh my God, 150 million people are voting on this. I cannot ignore this, because the collective voice is so loud and represents so many people that it's not just some poll that can be dismissed, you know, that somebody commissioned. These are actual people actually voting. I mean, it may be a virtual town square, but it's a real vote, and it's authenticated vote, just the same way, you know, any other vote would be authenticated. And it is able to stay pure in terms of its authentication, because we're not talking about, you know, tens of thousands of polling places. We're talking about one singular voting module on that particular issue, which is relatively simple to protect and to ensure the integrity of. Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense. And that brings us to another question that people have had. How is this different than just the regular public opinion polling that goes on all the time?
Well, I suppose the simplest answer is a public opinion poll really involves almost 0% of the population. I mean, you know, typically a poll that's commissioned, you will poll anywhere from, you know, 1,000 to 1,500 people generally. But as a percentage of the voting population, that's like 0.000000%. And so, you know, so what we have with a poll is, you know, we have a result that from which pollsters and whoever wants to can extrapolate the sentiments of the collective. But the collective, you know, voters didn't really participate in that. That wasn't a vote. That was an extrapolation based on a minuscule sampling. So, you know, the collective citizenry has no stake in that poll. And that's also the reason why politicians can ignore a poll, right? Because even if a poll is seemingly striking in like the support that it indicates, you know, for or against a position, you know, it makes one news cycle, then it's gone. And, you know, the politicians don't have to worry about millions of people holding them accountable because millions of people did not participate in the poll. The poll is an extrapolation. A vote is the expression of democracy. Not an extrapolation. It's the literal expression of democracy when we vote, and we don't vote in a poll. They're two different animals.
You know, that's why, as you said earlier, I encourage people to go buy this book and read the book, because there is so much in there that amplifies and that handles a lot of these ideas and objections. This is a very, very well thought out project, which is probably why it's taken all these years. I want to offer a quote here, because I think this is really a very important meta quote. By accessing and quantifying our common sense one issue at a time in an authenticated, secure, easy to use way that gives each citizen a voice and a vote, we can begin to define our collective values, desires, and priorities as a nation, and in so doing, transcend the partisanship and polarization that has gripped our democracy. And I know you and I have had these conversations before, where we're looking at this new institution somehow as a way of gleaning our new common sense, what we commonly sense together, something which the polarized system that we have right now, where people have to somehow, when push comes to shove, fall into whichever party more closely approximates who they are, even if it doesn't really. Say more about this new common sense idea of how we will learn more about ourselves through this institution.
Well, you know, fast forwarding, let us say, to a point where that this institution has been launched and has participation and has the credibility, which has attracted the participation. And now suddenly there's a way for each individual to have a vote and collectively to have a voice, right? So this goes in a sense, no pun intended, but beyond just the political issues, although that's where it would be expressed. But, you know, we've never really had in our society before a way to gauge our collective sense, right? Our sentiments. And that's, I mean, we use the term common sense, and that generally has always meant to people, well, you know, what anybody would feel, right? It was kind of obvious, or, you know, most people commonly would think a certain way. But that's fairly general. What we're talking about here is very specific. I mean, down to the individual, if we want to know, okay, for instance, what are our spending priorities, right? Well, there's a voting module that we could have where people just rank, just by dragging and dropping, you know, the top areas in which our federal budget is spent, and then, you know, rank them into their particular individual preferred order, but then collectively we would see where does the country stand. Well, that's a reflection of our common sense. Like, you know, we feel as a group at that point that, you know, at the top of our desires, our priority would be, and I'm just assuming that this is not it, but let's just say that, you know, top priority might be, you know, education, right? Or maybe the top priority in terms of spending, you know, it has to do with infrastructure or perhaps, you know, entitlements. You know, I'm just kind of using examples, but the idea to your question is that we have a means of having very high resolution in understanding, you know, as a group, what, you know, what is our sense about anything, any issue, any trend, you know, what are our priorities? Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. It does make sense. And of course, one of the subtext issues, and I think this is where some of the elites have been rather wary about putting too much power, even if it's advisory power, into the hands of ordinary people, is that how educated are people? How well will they, are they simply going to reflect what they've heard through their own silo? Just say just a little bit about how some of these issues, as people are voting on them, and incidentally, as you said earlier, people can change their vote and as many times as they want. What is it in the system that might actually make the citizen wiser?
Well, you know, first of all, the system is not going to change human nature, right? I mean, there will always be like a, you know, a segment of the human psyche that, you know, of society, therefore, that adopts a view and, you know, nothing's going to change their view, right? But I don't believe that that's a large section. I mean, I think that that exists. And so looking at the larger segment of society, which is, okay, people who, you know, genuinely want to know things and want to make educated decisions, those that do, within the National Town Square, there's the opportunity to establish verified factual information that can be presented as part of the educational process. So some, you know, just like when you get a voter's guide before you go to vote every couple of years, you know, online you would have the ability within a voting module for a particular issue to, for instance, watch a video that explains, okay, here's the basic facts about this particular issue. Now, right now, the problem we have is people like their own set of facts, right? Like alternative facts or whatnot. And, you know, a lot of, unfortunately, some of the fallout from the current political environment is that there's been so much doubt cast into the general population about the source of information that even when generally it's, you know, pretty much easy to know what's true and what isn't, there's still a segment that if they receive information that's knowingly been promoted that is actually false, they're still exposed to it. But within the National Town Square, that wouldn't happen. So, you know, those same people would be able to go there and say, oh, wow, you know, I've had a different view, but I'm seeing that people who are, you know, of completely different opinions about everything agree that these particular facts that I'm being educated with are true. And so that helps establish, again, a new chance, a new opportunity to have verified facts and to reclaim some of this territory for, you know, legitimacy that's been lost in the current environment.
And the current environment, which has been extremely politically polarized, where people do get their information from a silo, you know, it's been 36 or 37 years since Walter Cronkite last said, and that's the way it is. And since that time, we have really devolved into alternative views. And I feel very heartened by this particular idea because it gives us the opportunity, as you had suggested earlier, to find out what we commonly sense above and beyond the media talk bites and the polarization and so on. So we're down to our last 3 minutes here, Richard. The hour has really flown. I just want to say that in 2 weeks, on February 6th, we'll have you back and we'll have the National Town Square Director Strategic Outreach, Reverend Lupton Apshire, here And you people out there listening right now will have the opportunity to call in with your questions and comments. So I'm devoting that second show to this as well, because there is so much about this issue, and it has so much potential. Having been around the political scene for many, 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 many years, this is one of the first things that I've seen that has the potential to move the dial. And we're, you know, we're definitely at the very beginning stages of launching this. I think that I'm very, very excited about it. And I encourage everybody out there to go to Amazon or wherever you can, buy the book. It's called Virtual Country Strategy for 21st Century Democracy. Again, if a lot of people buy the book now, it will definitely give the book more notice. It'll run it up the pop charts on Amazon.com. And some of the mainstream venues will have to take a look and comment on it as well. Richard, we got about a minute left. Anything you want to share or add that might help people understand just a little bit more about this idea?
Well, what I would say is go to the website, virtualcountry.us, and that's a great starting point to understand what this
Very
is about,
good.
And then call in a couple of weeks.
Thank you, Richard Lang, for introducing National Town Square. Steve Behrman, Wiki Politiki, will be with you next time.